Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have some science reports, and Alice Bryant brings us education tips. We close the show with our American History program, The Making of a Nation. But first, here's John Russell.
Scientists recently used 3D imaging technology to look inside the mummies of a cat, bird, and snake. The research is helping experts learn more about how ancient Egyptians treated animals. Researchers said last week that they used a special technique, X-ray micro CT scanning, to look inside the mummies. The scanning process permits the scientists to study the mummies while keeping them whole. The CT scans were much more detailed than medical CT scans. The researchers published their findings in the journal Scientific Reports. Ancient Egyptians mummified not only humans, but also many animals, including cats, dogs, birds, snakes, and crocodiles. Carolyn Graves Brown, a writer of the study, leads the Egypt Center at Swansea University in Britain. She noted that the three mummies were likely made as votive offerings, or gifts, to the gods that Egyptians believed in. The dead animals were thought to serve as a link between Egyptian gods and living people. The mummies had long been in Swansea's collection. Experts are not sure of their exact age. The researchers found evidence that the snake, a young Egyptian cobra, had been denied water while alive. It was likely killed by a severe break of its backbone. The researchers found the snake's mouth open. It also contained a substance called natron. These findings suggest the snake had been part of an opening of the mouth ceremony, said Swansea engineering professor Richard Johnston. Johnston was the lead writer of the report. Ancient Egyptians believed that the ceremony would permit the mummified subjects to regain their senses in the afterlife. Graves Brown noted that the finding supports earlier evidence that the act was carried out with animals. The scientist added, "We know it was carried out on humans." The cat was probably around 5 months old when it died. Its neck was broken at the time of death or during the mummification process. The bird appears to be a Eurasian kestrel of the falcon family. Ancient Egyptians linked snakes to many of their gods. Cats were often linked with the fertility goddess Bastet. Some birds were linked with sky gods, such as Re and Horus. Like us, the ancient Egyptians used and abused animals, Graves Brown said. There is evidence from the mummified remains of maltreatment. I'm John Russell.
Officials in the Florida Keys plan to release genetically modified mosquitoes next year in an effort to fight insect-borne diseases. Genetically modified means an organism's genetic structure has been changed through genetic engineering. The test project in the Keys, a group of islands off Florida's southern coast, will involve the Aedes aegypti mosquito. The mosquito is not native to Florida, but it does transmit several diseases to humans, including dengue fever and the Zika virus. In the Keys, nearly 50 cases of dengue have been reported so far this year. The project is led by biotechnology company Oxitec. It is an American-owned company based in Britain. The plan calls for the release of millions of male genetically modified mosquitoes to mate with females that bite humans. The company says its male mosquitoes, which do not bite, are genetically engineered with a protein that makes any female offspring unable to survive. The process aims to lower the overall population of the insects to reduce the transmission of disease. Kevin Gorman is an Oxitec scientist. He told the Associated Press the company completed similar projects in the Cayman Islands and Brazil that went extremely well. "We have released over a billion of our mosquitoes over the years," Gorman said. "There is no potential for risk to the environment or humans." In a press release, Oxitec noted numerous studies by government agencies supporting the safety of the project. The Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention approved the experimental project. Several government agencies in Florida approved it as well. Some groups, however, worry that the use of genetically modified organisms could change the planet's natural balance. At a recent meeting of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control Board, several people questioned the effects of the project. "You have no idea what that will do," Barry Ray told the board. He is the director of the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition. Some experts have also questioned whether or not the modified mosquitoes can effectively crash the mosquito population in Florida as planned. The mosquitoes created in a lab have not gone through a natural selection process in which only the fittest survive and mate, said Max Marino, an expert in mosquito-borne diseases at Indiana University. He is not involved with the company or the test project. Marino asked, "Once they are released in the natural environment, will they be as fit as the naturally occurring males and able to outcompete them for mates?" Another question is whether the mosquitoes could have unplanned effects on the environment. For example, if a spider, frog, or bird eats the mosquito, will the modified protein have any effect on the predator? Marino said an ecosystem is so complex and involves so many species that it would be nearly impossible to test all of them beforehand in a laboratory. Still, Keys Mosquito Board members voted 4-1 in favor of the project. One of the supporters was Jill Cranny Gage. She told the meeting that insecticides and other chemical methods have become less effective against the Aedes aegypti mosquito. "The science is there," Cranny Gage said. "We're trying everything in our power, and we're running out of options." I'm Brian Lynn.
Have you ever recorded yourself on an electronic device while speaking English? If so, what kinds of things did you notice? Recording yourself gives you the chance to listen to and critique your English speaking skills. You can take note of things like sentence structure, word choice, pronunciation, and fluency. This can give you a better idea of what your strengths are and which areas need more work. Today on Education Tips, we will talk about two recording activities you can do to strengthen your speaking skills. The first activity involves narrative storytelling. William Stout teaches at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. His specialty is teaching English as a foreign language. He says some speaking activities do not give an accurate picture of your true language skills, but narrative storytelling does. Narrative storytelling is the retelling of a story. It can be a short piece of fiction, such as a program from the VOA Learning English series, American Stories, or it can be the retelling of a news event. Or you can talk about something that happened in your own life. For the narrative storytelling activity, Stout says, try to provide as many details as possible and aim for a recording of 3 minutes or fewer.
Don't just say, I studied at the library. Say, I walked into the library and I thought about where I should sit, and most of the seats were taken, so I looked around and I finally found a spot that was near the window, but it was chilly and I had to keep my coat on. Something like that.
Before the activity, Stout suggests speaking out loud to yourself a few times to make sure you have your main points in mind. When listening to the recording, do not expect to find all or even most grammar or vocabulary mistakes, he says. But you can easily find some mistakes, such as wrong verb tenses, verb endings, and noun endings. After the first recording, Stout says, record yourself telling the same story at least once more and take note of your progress. But avoid memorizing your speech. The second activity involves giving and getting directions. Winter Oshiberu teaches English in the Washington, D.C. area. She works for the International Center for Language Studies and Montgomery Community College. Oshiberu says giving directions is a real-world skill and one you can use almost anywhere. The first step in the activity is to choose a starting point and a destination. For the starting point, she says, choose a place that you know well, like your home or a nearby bus or train station. For the destination, choose a place you need to travel to more often, such as a supermarket, train station, your workplace, or favorite eating place. Then, record yourself giving the directions. The recording should not be longer than 1 minute. Oshiberu says the activity is a good way to employ the imperative form, also known as the command form. In English, the command form begins with a verb, as in, turn right when you reach the doctor's office.
The correct way is if you're telling someone what to do, you might want to start off with, first you go right on 7th Street, or first you turn right on 7th Street, or just turn right on 7th Street.
Avoid adding the modal verb can, which Oshiberu notes is a common mistake of English learners. For example, avoid saying something like, you can turn right on 7th Street. When listening to your recording, take note of your subject-verb agreement, use of prepositions, use of the command form, and pronunciation. You can even try using your own directions yourself, Oshiberu adds. In other words, play the recording as you walk from the starting point to the destination. This will let you know whether your directions were clear and accurate. Another way to practice getting directions is to use your phone's GPS or global positioning system. To do this, she suggests changing the language settings on the GPS system to English. Then, choose a destination to get walking directions to, a place that is not too far away. Set the GPS so you can listen to the directions and then follow the directions to the destination. Oshiberu says listening to directions is useful because when you give directions to a real person, they are probably going to ask questions. That brings our program to a close. As you try these speaking activities, remember to relax and enjoy the process. And don't forget to celebrate the things you do well. Let us know how it goes. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the United States Constitution. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. That Constitution, with other amendments added over the years, is still the law of the land. The delegates agreed to start the convention as soon as seven states were represented. On May 25th, they finally began. They gathered in the same room where America's Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The first important decision was choosing a president for the convention. Several of the delegates urged the others to choose George Washington. Washington was the most famous man in America. He had led the forces that won the war for independence from Britain. The delegates agreed. Washington was their choice. George Washington officially opened the convention with a short speech. He thanked the delegates for naming him president of the convention. But he said the honor was too great. He asked the delegates to forgive him if he made mistakes. After all, he said, he had never been chairman of a meeting before. With those words, George Washington sat down. Here are two actors playing George Washington and James Madison. They discuss Washington's role in writing the Constitution.
As for that document, I merely stood back and let the learned gentlemen do their work. I believe I spoke only once in convention, and that to a minor point.
Well, I believe you do yourself an injustice, sir. As president of the convention, you led the way.
Washington did lead the way, but it was not a straight path. From the beginning, the delegates agreed that they had the right to change their decisions. This was the rule. The convention did not just discuss a proposal, vote on it, and move on to other issues. Any delegate could ask to again discuss any proposal or any decision, and they often did. The same speeches that were made the first time were made again. So days, even weeks, passed between discussions of the same proposal. The delegates also agreed on a rule of secrecy. Guards were placed at the doors of the State House. Newspaper reporters were not allowed inside. And the delegates were not allowed to discuss convention business in public. The secrecy rule led people to think all kinds of things about the convention. This was true especially in Europe. There, most people believed the convention was discussing how America could be ruled by a king. Europeans said a republican government worked in a small country, such as Switzerland, but it would not work, they said, in a land as large as America. At the time of the convention, Thomas Jefferson was serving as America's representative to France. When he learned of the secrecy rule, he was angry. He believed strongly in freedom of speech and freedom of the press. More than 40 years later, James Madison explained the decision behind the secrecy rule. Madison said that if the convention had been open to the public, no delegate would ever have changed his mind after speaking on an issue. To do so would mean he was wrong the first time he spoke, and no delegate would be willing to admit to the public that he had made a mistake. This was Madison's reasoning. If the meetings had been open, he said, the convention would have failed. Another rule helped the delegates speak freely. They used a method of debate known as the Committee of the Whole. It was useful then, and it is still used today in legislatures. Votes taken in the committee are not recorded as final votes. The Committee of the Whole provides a way for people to discuss ideas and vote, but also to change their minds. To have the Philadelphia Convention become a Committee of the Whole, the delegates needed to elect a chairman of the committee. They chose Nathaniel Gorham, a judge from Massachusetts. Each morning at 10 o'clock, the convention met and declared that it was sitting as a committee of the whole. George Washington then left the president's chair. Nathaniel Gorham took his place. Just before 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Committee of the Whole declared it was sitting again as a convention. Gorham would step down, Washington would take the chair, and declare that the convention would meet again the next morning. This process was repeated each day. Because of these rules, the story of the Philadelphia Convention would be difficult to understand if we told about events day by day. So we will put the calendar and the clock away and tell how each major issue was debated and settled. On May 29th, the delegates heard what was called the Virginia Plan. This was the plan of government prepared by James Madison and other delegates from Virginia. The Virginia Plan did more than suggest changes to the Articles of Confederation. It was, in fact, a plan for a completely new central government. Immediately, the 33-year-old governor of Virginia, Edmund Randolph, proposed an amendment. The Virginia plan, he noted, spoke of a federal union of states. But such a federation would not work, he said. Instead, Randolph suggested that the central government should be a national government. It should contain a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. For a few moments, there was complete silence. Many of the delegates seemed frozen in their chairs. Did they hear correctly? Most of them did not question the idea of a government with three separate branches. Several states already had such a system. But to create a central government that was national and supreme, what did these words mean exactly? What was the difference? The delegates debated the meaning of the words federal, national, and supreme for many days. Both James Madison and a Pennsylvania delegate, Governor Morris, tried to explain. Madison said a federal government acts on states. A national government acts directly on the people. Morris gave this explanation. A federal government is simply an agreement based on the good faith of those involved. A national government has a complete system of operation and its own powers. Governor Morris pointed out that one day the delegates meeting in Philadelphia would be dead. Their children and grandchildren, he said, would stop thinking of themselves as citizens of Pennsylvania or New York or North Carolina. Instead, they would think of themselves as citizens of the United States. Morris said the states had to take second place to a national government with supreme power. Other delegates presented their own plans for discussion. Alexander Hamilton of New York suggested giving the national government almost unlimited powers. Hamilton's ideas were not popular. After Hamilton's five-hour speech, one delegate said, "Hamilton is praised by everybody. He is supported by no one." New Jersey also offered a plan. An actor playing James Madison at a museum in Washington, D.C. says that plan was not popular either.
And William Paterson unveiled the New Jersey plan, calling for one house of equal representation. I knew that Delaware, Rhode Island, and the other small states would never go along with that.
Delegates voted to reject the New Jersey plan. They did not even vote on Hamilton's plan. From that time, all their discussions were about the plan presented by Virginia. For more than 3 months, delegates would debate each part, vote on it, then debate it again. The Virginia Plan formed the basis of discussion at the convention in Philadelphia. In the end, it formed the basis of the United States Constitution.
And that's our show. But we'll be back tomorrow with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.